Welcome to the Meb Faber Show, where the focus is on helping you grow and preserve your wealth. Join us as we discuss the craft of investing and uncover new and profitable ideas, all to help you grow wealthier and wiser. Better investing starts here.
Meb Faber is the co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambria Investment Management. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Cambria's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Cambria Investment Management or its affiliates. For more information, visit CambriaInvestments.com.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Founders Card. I usually don't spring for paid membership programs, but this one is a little different. The offering is targeted entrepreneurs and business owners, and the card enables premier benefits from leading airlines, hotels, lifestyle brands, and business services. A few of my favorite benefits include free access to MailChimp Pro, Dashlane Premium, and TripIt Pro. You can even get big discounts of services I love like Silvercar, 99 Designs, Apple, and AT&T. My favorite, though, are the travel benefits, where you get an automatic status such as Hilton Honors Gold, American Airlines Platinum, and Virgin America Gold. And while I often use the great app Hotel Tonight for travel, the Founders Card discounts can be massive too. If you go to founderscard.com/Meb, podcast listeners can sign up for the discount at $395 a year with no initiation fee, and that's a saving from the normal cost of around $600 per year. Again, that's founderscard.com/Meb. Happy post July 4th, podcast listeners. Super excited today to have a good friend on the show. We're bringing on a partner of one of our very first guests. If you remember, one of the first episodes was Wes Gray. We're bringing on his partner at Alpha Architect, the CFO, CIO of Alpha Architect, Jack Vogel. Welcome to the show.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on.
I'm having trouble spitting my words out after this long 5-day weekend, but the last time I saw Jack was in a karaoke bar down in Dana Point. And Jack, I don't think you got up on stage, did you?
No, I was probably for everyone's benefit, just staying in the crowd, enjoying everyone else's singing experience.
Well, I wasn't planning on getting on the stage, but Tom Lydon, our good friend from ETF Trends, was doing a brutally bad, just massacring Baby Got Back by Sir Mix-a-Lot. So I had to go steal the mic and take over for him. But he had a beautiful voice and did many other great songs and was a gracious host. So we had a lot of fun. And we were just down at the Ritholtz IMN evidence-based conference where we were both speaking and where Meb and Jeff were. They tried to not let us into the happy hour golf party, but eventually did. Anyway, let's get cranking today. So Jack, why don't you give us a little bit of origin story? I've known you for years now, but give the listeners a little. What was the path progression that eventually spat you out at Alpha Architects? Do you always want to grow up to be a quant finance researcher?
I don't know if that was necessarily the case. So, but it evolved, and I love what I do. So, good question. Basically, I graduated undergrad as a math education major, so I'm technically certified in PA as a high school math teacher. And I was in a PhD in math program, and during my second year, I kind of realized I did not want to do perpetual research on matrices and linear algebra in math. Nor did I really want to go work for, you know, the NSA or something like that. So I became interested in finance, and I switched to the PhD in finance program at Drexel. And that's kind of where I met Wes. So Wes had graduated from Chicago and was placed and hired as a professor at Drexel. And in PhD programs in general, you end up working kind of closely with a professor. And I just got assigned to Wes and kind of liked the business side as well as the research side of finance, as opposed to doing like pure academic research. And that's how I've kind of got into working with Wes at Alpha Architect. And Meb, I know I've been working with you, I think it was back in, 2011 or whatever, whenever you did your shareholder yield book, I was kind of helping Wes out with you and figuring out some
intimately involved. Well, I mean, you know, had you never met Wes, you would probably still have an ACL. I mean, I remember you just Wes's goofy basketball playing, I think, caused you to blow out your knee. But you're fully recovered at this point, or close, right?
Yeah, pretty close. Yeah, basketball in the driveway at someone's house, Wes's house, can be very dangerous to your ACLs. That is a true statement. But yeah, I'm pretty much.
Wes's house, also known as Alpha Architects Global Headquarters. I also don't have an ACL on one of my knees from playing hoops, so I think I retired after doing that. Anyway, let's get back to the topic on hand. So Jack's written like a dozen white papers. You can find them on SSRN with all sorts of names, like using maximum drawdowns to capture tail risk. Does complexity imply value? Which is one of my favorite papers, by the way. We're not going to talk about today, but it looks at all the AAII, American Association of Individual Investor Value Strategies, all the way back to 1963. That may be my favorite paper to y'all, but it's one of the least read. So we'll put show notes up for all those. You've done three books, like a gazillion white papers, but I figured we'd kind of go through the flow a little bit and see how long, first of all, we can go without saying the term smart beta. I feel like the first person to say it has to owe happy hour on this podcast. But let's talk about factors. So it's an area you guys work a ton on. You've written two books, co-authored books with Wes on this topic, one called Quantitative Value, one called Quantitative Momentum. So I want to talk about each. And in particular, you've actually distilled them into some really beautiful white papers. Let's start with value. And you guys got a nice white paper called Our Quantitative Value Philosophy. You want to give us a quick overview? Actually, I wanted to read a quote that'll lead in, and then I'll just let you run from there. It says, quantitative is often considered to be an opaque mathematical black art, only practiced by ivory tower academics and practitioners with their heads in the clouds. Nothing could be further from the truth. Quantitative or systematic processes are merely tools that value investors can use to minimize their unavoidable instincts. Quantitative tools serve two purposes: protect us from our own behavioral errors, and two, to exploit the behavioral errors of others. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about the value philosophy in general, and we can get into the nitty-gritty of the steps you guys take to forming a portfolio.
Sure. Yeah, so I like the quote you started with there. You know, and basically the whole idea and part of that quote is to understand that, you know, quantitative can have can cause weird reactions for people. Some people think, oh, you're a quant, you're just, you know, looking to optimize data and run regressions to figure out what was the best way in the past to invest, and that may not necessarily be true in the future. And the whole idea behind, I guess, all our processes is we just use tools, quantitative, i.e. a computer, to do a lot of the heavy lifting that a security analyst, especially for value, like a fundamental security analyst, would end up doing themselves. We just use the computer to kind of sort through and sift through all the data, because computers are just a lot quicker than humans are. And then as far as value goes, I'll start with that before we get into details. You know, value investing has been around forever. And just to be clear, Wes wrote Quant Value with Toby. I helped do all the data on there, though, so I kind of know implicitly all the nuances of that process. But on value investing, what is it essentially? You know, just buying cheap stuff, and the whole outline and the process of the quant value philosophy is basically to try to say what would be, you know, the best way to use a computer, in our opinion, to be a value investor.
So you list five steps in the paper, and we could talk about each of them at length, or I'll let you talk about them. But there are. You start with the universe, you then move to forensic accounting screens, valuation screens, quality screens, and then investing with conviction. So why don't you take us a little bit through that process, starting at how you really kind of construct a portfolio based on the universe of stocks.
Sure. Yeah, so the first step is, you know, constructing the universe, right? And the whole idea there is, you want to make sure when you're building portfolios, especially that have any types of scale, that one can actually invest in them, right? So, you know, something in the academic databases, like FAMA has a good paper called Dissecting Anomalies, where he highlights that within the databases, you know, 60% of the firms in there are what would be considered microcap stocks, and they only account for 2% of the market value of the U.S. investable universe. So, you know, you want to like kick them out. So I guess that's the first step, is kind of look at mid-large cap stocks that are investable. And then the second step is forensic accounting. And for value investing, as many people know, one of the issues is you don't want to be caught catching the falling knife, right? You don't want to catch stocks that may be doing something that may be cheap for a reason. And so this is one way at the outset where we use a couple of forensic accounting screens, such as high accrual firms, firms with higher probability of financial distress, and high probability of bankruptcy. And we use them to just eliminate, you know, around 5 to 10% of the universe. And to be clear, that step, what that will do is you're going to have a ton of false positives where you kick out a firm and they, you know, they don't go bankrupt or they don't have financial distress. But on average, if you look and just say, hey, we're going to take the universe of 1,000 stocks, kick out 5 or 10%, in the past, that was actually like a good bet. That was just, you know, it added some value, had, you know, slightly better summary stats.
I think it has a derivative benefit, which is if you're like kind of like skimming the scum off the top of a pond, and if it keeps you from owning some really terrible name that goes bankrupt into zero, that regardless of whether it's a compounded return portfolio to statistic benefit, there's the benefit of not owning that turd, right? Like you feel better about not owning some bankrupt stock and question your process.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just one way, especially when you're doing it, and I think this goes back to kind of that quote you were talking about, like the quantitative, and we always get people that ask, hey, well, what about a quantum mental approach when you kind of look at the stock names and add that human element that you're going to say, hey, we're going to screen out this name or that name. I think it kind of maybe just makes you sleep better at night, as you kind of mentioned, because if you're not going to be screening the names at the end from a human aspect, you know, having a screen like that can be beneficial.
All right. So you get rid of the junk. And then next, how do you guys approach value? A lot of different investors use different value factors or have a different approach to value. What's y'all's?
Yeah, so we're kind of big fans of enterprise multiples, which is, you know, you can measure it by EBIT or EBITDA over total enterprise value.
Explain.
Yeah, and so basically it's, you know, taking earnings, and what total enterprise value is it's basically if one had to buy the firm, how much would it cost to buy the entire firm? So you basically add up market capitalization plus all the debt plus, you know, maybe minority interest or preferred stock. So anything you would need to do, you need to buy out all the equity holders and all the debt holders, and then you subtract off cash, right? So if you look at Apple, you know, Apple clearly has got around like $200 billion, or I forget what the number is now, but they have a ton of cash, so you get to subtract that off of the total enterprise value for Apple. And so that's one way to measure it. And how do we settle on such a measure? Well, Wes and I actually have a paper. It's in the Journal of Portfolio Management. And we wrote this back in 2011 or 2012. I forget now. And we basically said, hey, we're just going to do a performance horse race across different value multiples. So we looked at book to market, PE ratios, free cash flow to total enterprise value, enterprise multiples, and we even looked at forward analyst estimates. And we said, hey, we're just going to look at the spread between value and growth. And what we found was enterprise multiples in the past did the best at predicting the so-called value premium in U.S. stocks, and also in international stocks. There's another paper, and there's other academic papers that found that this is a decent value measure. And so we looked at that and said, hey, we like enterprise multiples. We kind of like it because another just theory as to why it may work well is, you know, a lot of enterprise multiples is how some private equity investors would value a firm, right? They'd say, okay, it's earning this much. To buy the whole companies, you gotta look at the total enterprise value. That's the multiple that we chose. You could use, you know, a couple different multiples if you wanted to, but we just like to keep it simple. So we basically take, like, getting back to our screen, if we start with 1,000 stocks, step two, we kick out 10% for easy math, so you're down to 900. And then in step three, which really is the most important step, we kick out, we go directly to the top 10% cheapest firms, so you're down to 90 stocks.
Okay. And then the final, I think it's the final step, which is quality. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, so quality can mean a lot of things, could be measured a million ways. The way we think of quality is we look at it through like the lens, we kind of think of it as like a table, right? So for a table to stand up, you kind of need to have a couple legs. So two of the legs we think of are like long-term. For our U.S. screen, we look at long-term measures of quality. And what we look at is free cash flow over assets over, you know, an eight-year period. Another measure is we look at a combination, and we take the percentile ranks on both margin growth and margin stability. So clearly you may not be able to, like, great firms might not be able to have high margin growth, but they may have super stable margins, right? So Procter & Gamble's 50 or 55% margin stability, we kind of make like a Sharpe ratio out of, like, you know, your margin divided by the standard deviation of your margins over 8 years. And we also look at other measures such as like return on capital and return on assets over 8 years. So 50% of our quality score is like a long-term quality score. And then the other, you know, two legs of our table are the what we call the it's like a pre-flight checklist, where we look at the current financial strength of the firm. And what that is it's basically like 10 year-over-year measures just to make sure that the firm that we're buying isn't going to go bankrupt next year or isn't in current financial distress. It's doing pretty well from a year-over-year basis.
And so you come down to a pretty concentrated list. What is it, down to a final 50 names?
Yeah. So for the value portfolios, we go down to the top 40, 45 names around there.
I tossed that you were coming on the podcast to Twitter, and one of the questions was, you know, what does Jack and the crew estimate as kind of capacity? You mentioned that you're focusing mainly on large cap stocks. When you know, fund crushes it, you guys do amazing. Where do you see you start to turn the dials a little bit when you get to a certain size? Is it like 5 billion, 10 billion? Where do you think the, if you have any thoughts on that in general?
Yeah, so what I'd, that's a great question. I saw that question on Twitter there. And something Wes and I have thought about. So probably for value, the way it's currently constructed, where it's like 40, 45 stocks equal weighted, and they're mid to large cap, you can probably go up to around 1 billion without doing any tweaks, right? Around that time, and again, this is assuming you're running the portfolio at the same time, right? So, right. You know, if you're rebalancing it at different times, you may be able to add capacity. But let's assume you want to run it as one bucket, and on, you know, one day you want to rebalance the whole thing. So, but then after that, you know, you can still make minor tweaks and probably get a lot more capacity in the fund. But you definitely would have to probably change that end portfolio construction, where in step five right now, it's like, hey, we go to 40 to 45 names and equal weight. You know, maybe it's you add a couple more names, or you do some sort of screen where maybe larger caps get a slightly higher weight. But that's a great question.
Right. And there's a lot of things you can do. I mean, Jack mentions rolling rebalances, which is certainly one, as well as many others. It'll be a good problem to have when you guys hit that 5, 10 billion capacity. Happy hour on you. Well, let's flip to a totally different, for many people, a lot of podcast listeners will hear this, and, you know, so many people are, you know, self-described value guys or buy and hold guys or whatever it may be, whatever your investment approach, dividend income guys, you know, almost a totally opposite left brain, right brain sort of approach is momentum investing. So you had a cool quote at the beginning of this one too. So I'm gonna read that. It said, "Why might momentum be an interesting stock selection tool? It says, first, Eugene Fama, the 2014 co-recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economics and father of the efficient market hypothesis, has summarized the academic research on momentum as follows. Quote, the premium anomaly is momentum, end quote. When the father of efficient markets suggests momentum is a leading anomaly, we take note. So talk to us a little bit about momentum, because you guys have written what I would consider to be the most comprehensive, well-researched summary of the momentum literature. So give us a little overview, and then we'll break it out into the similar five steps.
So Wes and I guess a year and a half ago, wrote Quantitative Momentum, which was just a compilation of a lot of posts and papers and research that we had kind of gone through over the years. But really the goal of that book was to kind of outline for investors why momentum investing is, and momentum investing may be beneficial to your portfolio. And, you know, this comes from the lens of like Wes and myself. We both kind of grew up as like value investing, you know, disciples, right? You know, you read Intelligent Investor, you see Warren Buffett, you're like, oh, I'm going to be a value investor. And then what you come to realize is that momentum investing can be beneficial to your portfolio. And as I mentioned earlier, it's really beneficial for value investors. So we wanted to outline in that book kind of the first couple chapters, we really try to highlight how it's beneficial and also how it is definitely different than growth investing. Because a lot of times what happens is for value investors, they just know buy value, don't buy growth, right? Like that's kind of the gospel. And it's important, I think, to differentiate the two and highlight, hey, you know, momentum stocks are not necessarily growth stocks. And so that's kind of what we did.
And explain what you mean by it. So for listeners, like growth stock, when you're talking about growth, like explain the difference just real quick, and then we'll keep drilling down on momentum.
Yeah. So momentum, the way we measure it is we use what's simple called price momentum. I.e., you look at the total return of a stock over the past year. So if you had 1,000 stocks, you know, you'd buy the top decile or 20%, right? Whereas a growth portfolio is if you had 1,000 stocks, you would rank all the firms on, let's say, PE ratios, and a growth investor would buy those with the highest PE ratio, and a value investor would buy those with the lowest PE ratio. So, you know, the overlap historically, I think, was like in our book was like 27% around there of the top decile of growth stocks and the top decile of momentum stocks. So they're definitely not the same thing in our according to the data.
Okay, so back to the momentum screen. So you do the first step, which is similar to the value. So you're only looking at mid, large cap, exchange traded stocks. Second, you just mentioned the momentum screen, which is the past 12 months, ignoring the first month. And this is where you kind of start to depart a little bit from what a lot of just very basic traditional momentum is. You add a little quality and then seasonality. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, and real quick, just to highlight in step two, momentum is actually a weird thing where if you look at short, like i.e. month over month, and long, like 3 to 5 years, stock returns historically actually reverse. So in step two, you want to look at like what's called intermediate term momentum, which is anywhere from like, you know, 6 to 15 months. But then as you mentioned, step three, so if we start with 1,000 stocks in step one, step two, we go down to the top 100 stocks based on their past 1 year return, excluding last month. And then step three, you're right. We definitely do something different where, and we call it the quality of momentum, not necessarily quality. And what we're looking for here is, the question is, and I like to give this example when people ask, what is this step supposed to do? So imagine you have two high momentum stocks that are both up 100%. Stock A, we'll call, you know, exciting biotech, which was just kind of bobbing around 0%, you know, jumping all over the place. And then, you know, 3 months ago, an FDA approval came out and it was up 100%, right? And then it was 0% thereafter. So stock A is up 100% because it had a one-day jump due to an FDA approval. stock B, I'm going to call Boring Big Box, right? And Boring Big Box has just returned 50 basis points for the past, 250 days, right? Or let's say 200 days. So stock B, boring big box, is also up 100%. A question in that one could ask is, well, in this example, which type of momentum stock would you want to own? And there's a cool paper that we kind of leverage. The title of the paper is called Frog in the Pan, right? Continuous information and momentum. And what it asks is essentially, which type of stocks would you want to own? And what they find is you want to own those stocks that people tend to overlook, those that have more continuous good information. So in my simple example, it would be the boring big box store and the exciting biotech firm. You would actually want to exclude them.
And part of that reason, we talk about a lot of people, momentum is because of that predictable underreaction to fundamentals. And so a lot of the steady eddy, people may be underreacting to that change, whereas and vice versa and the opposite. Okay. Next, you mentioned seasonality. What does that mean?
Yeah, so seasonality is just the question of, when does one rebalance the portfolio? And actually, this is a slightly interesting story. So when I was a PhD student, Wes and I were talking and kind of had an idea to examine the seasonality momentum, because we kind of just had this thought. We're like, hey, it could be the case that in quarter ending months, momentum may do really well due to people and, such as mutual funds and institutions where they have to disclose their holdings every quarter, right? And so by construction, if you want to make your portfolio look good on paper, right, where you only have to disclose once a quarter, what would you do? The natural idea would be you would have to buy the high momentum stocks in the quarter ending month, and you'd have to sell or get rid of all your crappy losing stocks, i.e. low momentum, right? And so we had this idea, found the results, which is kind of what we thought, which is that momentum premium looks great and works kind of the best in quarter ending months. And, as a PhD student, you just want to get papers published so you can graduate. And, looked at all the big journals and found no one had published, thought we were great. And then, we find out it was in, a practitioner journal. Someone had already found this result, in 2008. So, good that someone else had verified our result. But essentially what this step does is we say, hey, since the momentum premium seems to do really well in quarter ending months, what we do is we try to rebalance our portfolio right before those quarter ending months occur. So, you would want to rebalance at the end of November or the beginning of December in anticipation of people potentially buying up the high momentum names as the month went on so that they have them in their portfolio to show shareholders at the end of the quarter.
I'm looking forward to the days when we start front running you guys and then everybody starts front running us and we'll have to start rebalancing our end of year portfolio at the end of September. So we'll be a whole quarter ahead. Okay, so you end up the same thing with the portfolio, I think also 50 names, is that about right?
Yeah, around 50. 40, 50 yep, names? So we take the 50 names from we go from 1,000 to 100 to 50. And then step four is just when do we rebalance? That's correct.
So I think this is probably a good little segue. We talk a lot on this podcast and on the blog about indexing and when you start to move away from the market cap index. And we often say, look, if you're going to be different, be different. And so you guys have developed some pretty kick-ass tools. One feature on your website we've talked about before is your visual active share tool. So for any of our listeners who probably missed our discussions on this, maybe you could start by giving us a quick synopsis of what that is, the general thought process behind it, and then, of course, what y'all's tool actually does.
Yeah. So what Well, let me give you the genesis and kind of how and why we wanted to build this tool, right? So, as you mentioned, you know, if you're going to build a different portfolio, right? There's two ways to go about it. One way is you just kind of closet index and, you know, you build something, call it value, call it momentum, but it's really just the index. The other way is you build a truly unique portfolio. And so the question is, for a lot of people, investors and financial advisors in the marketplace, it's really hard to get through what I call like the cloud of marketing, i.e. you don't really know what you're buying because you can kind of easily be duped by good marketing, right? And so one way to measure it, there's a professor, Martin Kremers, has a couple of papers, and him and the AQR guys argue back and forth about the how good this measure is, but it's called active share. And what active share is you basically examine the weight in the portfolio and you compare it to the weight in the market cap weighted portfolio. And by doing this, you can create a measure that will vary from 0 to 1, where 0 means you are essentially the market cap weighted portfolio, i.e. your Vanguard, and 1 or 100%, right, means that you are completely different from the market. And so that's great, but it involves math, and there is some question as to, do you really just want to be different than the market? The answer is probably no. You want to be different, but you also want to have a tilt, right? And so as opposed to and I do recommend, you know, it's called activeshare.info. It's Martin Kremers has this pretty cool site. Recommend people to take a look at it. But as opposed to just doing this mathematical number-based formula that's going to range from 0 to 1, we were like, hey, this would be really neat if we could show for any given ETF, that's what we currently have, just ETFs, US ETFs, in the marketplace, what the actual underlying stocks are in the portfolio. And what I mean by that is, on the x-axis and y-axis, we allow anyone to pick what you want to rank something on. So you could rank it on market cap and book to market. And if you click on, you know, SPY, the S&P 500 ETF, you'll see that it's a it'll plot all of the little stocks in there, and the circles represent how big the each individual stock is in the portfolio. And you can compare different ETFs in this tool that we built. So one could actually say, okay, well, you say you're a value fund, let me compare you to the S&P 500 and see how different you really are.
And the nice thing about that is that so many, you know, people talk about stuff on kind of subjectively, but when you look at the visuals of this, it's actually kind of striking, because there's so many funds out there, what we call the closet indexers. And here's kind of the big rub, is that you can buy a lot of the buy and hold market cap weighted indexes for very, very low fees. S&P 500, 5 basis points. So 0.05%. You can get these funds, but a lot of the smart beta. No, my God. Am I the first one that said it?
You are.
Son of a.
I'm excited now.
Man.
I'm getting the most expensive mixed drink at the bar.
I've banned some phrases in the office. That's one of them. Anyway, yeah, you can say it as many times as you want now. So many of these funds that get marketed at high fees. And they may not look like high fees, so they may only be 0.5% or 0.8%, but you essentially are buying the S&P 500. And so there was actually an interesting podcast between Bill Miller and Barry Ritholtz, where Bill had estimated that something like 70% of active funds were really just closet indexers that charge in the mutual fund world 1-2% a year. What's the domain to go find this? Is it just on the Alpha Architect website?
Yeah, so on alphaarchitect.com, it's if you click on the tools button, you have to register and be a financial professional, but it's free. So, but yeah, you can check it out on our website.
So for investors, what's the kind of line in the sand? Is there a particular number they should be looking for when they're thinking of active share, or is it kind of some rules of thumb that you may give suggestions for?
Yeah, so I'll give a couple things. So maybe just let me go back to kind of what you had just mentioned previously, which is like how high of a fee people are actually paying, right? And so we're actually building a new tool. I hope it comes out at some point. And it's a tool that Kremers has as well. It's called Active Fee. And let me give you an example. So pretend you have like a smart beta fund that charges 30 basis points, right? If you have a let's say it has an active share of 10%, i.e. it's 90% the market, 10% active, right? If we assume that you can get the market for zero, let's just assume for simple math, that really means your active fee that you're paying there is like 30 bips divided by 10%. That's 3%. What I'd say is I think people should try to understand how much they're paying, what the active fee is for the funds that are invested in. And now directly answering your question, you know, what's like a good active share number? What I'd say is, and although I am a fan, and I think you are too, Mib, of high active share funds. Although I am, I would recommend that for each advisor and investor understand that the more active a portfolio is, the more it's going to have a higher tracking error. Right. So let's just say you're an advisor and you don't want to deviate from the index by more than, you know, 50 basis points. You then have two options, right? You can buy a lot of closet index smart beta funds, right? And you'll basically just bob around the index, or you can buy, you know, 90% S&P 500, and then on that other 10%, maybe buy some super highly active funds, and you'd probably get to the same destination. So I think it does vary from person to person, but personally, you know, if I wanted to track an index, I'd probably just recommend that investors pick a high percentage of passive, and then on whatever part they want to deviate, pick a more active fund as kind of the satellite.
And now a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is sponsored by FreshBooks, the best cloud-based small business accounting software. Look, I've never taken an accounting class in my life and found FreshBooks easy to navigate within the first 30 seconds. Here's an example. Say you're racing against the clock to wrap up three projects, prepping for a meeting later in the afternoon, all while trying to tackle a mountain of paperwork. Welcome to life as a freelancer. Challenging? Yep, but our friends at FreshBooks believe the rewards are so worth it. Look, the working world has changed. With the growth of the internet, there's never been more opportunities for the self-employed. To meet this need, FreshBooks is excited to announce the launch of an all-new version of their cloud accounting software. It's been redesigned from the ground up, custom-built for exactly the way you work. Get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid quickly. The all-new FreshBooks is not only ridiculously easy to use, it's also packed full of powerful features, such as create and send professional-looking invoices in less than 30 seconds. Set up online payments with just a couple of clicks and get paid up to 4 days faster. See when your client has seen your invoice and put an end to all the guessing games. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to my listeners. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/Meb and enter the Meb Faber Show in the How'd You Hear About Us section. Again, that's freshbooks.com/Meb. And now back to the show. We're going to pivot a little bit because we only have you for an hour and we're burning through time pretty quickly. I want to talk a little bit about your new ETF, and we can't really mention it online, so we'll talk about the research. But listeners, if you wanted to spell out the ticker name, it sounds like Voldemort. I don't know if that was intentional, but the evil wizard from Harry Potter. So we'll talk about the theory and research behind the index. And something, you know, our firm has in common with you guys is appreciation for not only value and momentum, but also trend. And you guys wrote a great white paper called The Value and Momentum Trend Philosophy. And in it, you talk about kind of just what you were just talking about. It says our indices are designed with a unique segment of investors that are long-term oriented, willing to invest the time to understand our processes and have enough courage to sometimes be vastly different from the crowd. So let's talk a little bit about how you construct this index and the philosophy behind the value momentum trend research.
Yeah. So basically, well, the value and momentum pieces, we kind of spilled out earlier. We kind of used the same philosophy on value and momentum, both in U.S. and international. And as I had mentioned before, you know, combining value and momentum, especially when you use price momentum like what we do, tends to have very good portfolio benefits. So how we actually combine those two is there's, I would say, two recommended approaches. One is like a simple equal weighting, i.e., you know, 50% value, 50% momentum. We've done that in the past. I would say for anyone at home that wants to combine the two, that's the simplest and probably good idea. What we do is we actually use risk parity between the two. And all risk parity does is it kind of, and these are equity, all equity portfolios. So you don't get huge deviations of weights, but risk parity generally will slightly overweight on average value relative to momentum. So, you know, usually it's like 55% value, 45% momentum, but that's clearly going to deviate over time. So that's how we combine the two. And then the next aspect is something I know, Meb, you're a fan of with what you guys do as well. And we'd recommend, you know, I still remember reading your paper on trend following a long time ago. But trend following, what do? Is we say, hey, you know, we just want to be invested when the trend rules are positive. So we look at 12-month both moving average rules and time series momentum for U.S. and international indices. And
explain what time series momentum for the readers, if not familiar.
Yeah, so time series momentum is it's actually very highly related to a moving average rule. All it does is it takes the total return to an index or whatever portfolio you have over the past year. So let's say your portfolio is up 10%. You then subtract off the return to cash or T-bills. So let's say it's 1% now, right? And if that number is greater than zero, that would indicate you should be invested. If it's negative, you would either sell or go to market neutral. And so we apply those rules on the S&P 500 and the EFI indices. We don't do it on the individual legs. We get that question a lot, like, why don't you apply the trend rules and time series momentum on value momentum? And we like to say, one is, you know, the evidence is it doesn't really add too much. And the second thing is trend following, we think, is kind of like it should be a broad thing where it's like big news. So we try to look at the big asset classes, i.e. U.S. stocks, which is the S&P 500, and international stocks, which is EFI, and kind of use those as the indicators as to whether or not stocks are trending up or down.
And theoretically, you could potentially get some added benefit of your portfolio stocks versus the S&P as well. So if you're using futures or whatever it may be to hedge, you may get the additional benefit of staying in that equities that outperform the S&P over time. So you put this all together, and I assume this sort of portfolio is probably totally long or mostly long at this point, right?
Yeah, currently it's pretty much... Well, it is. It's long only right now.
Pretty much 100%. Everything's going up this day and age. All right. So you have listeners of the show and be like, damn, everything you just said makes a lot of sense. And you guys have even written a book on this topic called Do-It-Yourself Financial Advisor that touches on a lot of the themes of rules-based portfolios, as well as doing it on your own, as well as potentially hiring an advisor, robo-advisor, automated advisor, which you guys also have one. What are your thoughts on kind of as you look across the universe of robo-advisors? You know, you guys, what you're doing is quite a bit different in the individual account solutions as well as the ETFs. What's kind of your experience and thoughts on the best way to implement it for people, or is there a best way?
Yeah, so I think for each investor, probably the most important thing is understanding their own behavior. You know, so as you mentioned, we have a robo advisor that essentially runs a strategy very similar to the one we outline in our book. And a lot of times, and you know, we even give the signals away on our website. So in theory, you know, if you read the book, you'd go to the website, and if you wanted to follow what we do, the trend following on the asset classes, you could just do it yourself. So natural question is, what, you know, why do some people sign up? I even had a guy today I was talking to on the phone, and I said, oh, well, you know, you really could just do it yourself. And he responded, well, I don't trust myself. And so I think the robo is good because in general it's a low fee. So ours is 25 bips. I know, Meb, yours is zero. I think there's a small fee that you have to pay as well for Betterment, but pretty much it's cheap, right? It's cheap asset allocation that one can get. As you mentioned, there's different solutions. So, you know, Vanguard and other portfolios are kind of just buy and hold portfolios. Then there's other firms like ours and yours that kind of have different portfolios that are, I would say, more customized and definitely different than your standard just buy and hold portfolio.
It'll be fun to watch it play out. You know, we've been a kind of a commentator, observer, participant in this space for many years now. And, you know, the big commentary for a lot of the critics has been that the automated solutions will really struggle during bear markets because they don't have the human element. And so it'll be kind of fun to see, you know, every bear market has a different personality. 1987 crash looks different than the 2000 bear market, which looks much different from the 2007. So fun is not the right word, but it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out, and particularly the tactical solutions like we both have versus the just buy and hold, et cetera, et cetera. So let's get to sort of the potpourri round, where we have a handful of shorter questions as well. Some tweeps have chimed in with their questions, with some shorter ones. You have done a significant amount of research for a pretty young fellow. What are you excited about most looking forward? You know, what are you, is there any, can we pull aside the curtain? Is there any things you're working on? Any unanswered questions you have that are particularly on the forefront of your brain?
Yeah. So, I mean, things that I get excited about is just, I really do love that visual active share tool we have, and we're probably going to build some other cool tools to help advisors and investors pull back the curtains for funds. And I'm just excited in general about, I think there will be in the next, you know, well, I think as millennials start to gain more assets as well as, you know, try to influence more decisions, you know, more data-driven decisions and more transparency as to, like, what one is buying. So kind of the tools on our website, I think, are, like, very beneficial to anyone who really wants to invest in ETFs. I don't know. I think that's kind of exciting, where you can now go in and be like, oh, well, I thought that ETF was a value ETF, but I realize it's really just buying the S&P 500. So maybe I will buy something else.
So a similar question, and this is kind of tangentially related, it may be too close, but it says, being a quant with so much market data has been mined already, is an area that you believe still holds a final frontier that the kind of quant can go to experience certain type of gains? Any thoughts there, or is that secret sauce?
In public equity markets?
I don't know. That was the question I read. So you can interpret it. You can apply it to sports betting. I know you're a sports fan. Have you ever turned your lens on quantitative sports betting at all?
I have not. I think probably because I'm more concerned that I will become fully enthralled and do nothing else but spend all my time on that. And one day I do look forward to doing that. What I'd say is anything in general where there's, I would say from a data standpoint, some sort of market friction or arbitrage is probably the best spot as far from a quant approach. You know, if you can just create a better way to get around that friction or arbitrage. But
we'll marinate on it. We'll have you back on in a year and we can talk about it again.
All right. All right.
Speaking of rabbit holes, I mean, I when I was living in Lake Tahoe once, and I don't have an addictive personality really, I remember buying my roommates had a video game system, and we were all varying degrees of kind of ski bums at the time. And one of them had bought Grand Theft Auto, and I played for something like 12 hours straight. It was the most depressing, I think, day of my life afterwards. And then we ended up returning the game. I was like, I can't have this around. This is terrible. So sort of similar idea on the sports betting. All right, so let's move on. What has been the greatest investing difference of opinion between you and Wes? Or is this like Dr. Evil and Mini-Me? Are you guys like clones of each other and when you're just like always agree? Is there anything where you guys are like hacking back and forth and you're like, Wes, you're an idiot. We can't be doing this, or you are a fool, or vice versa?
I don't know if there's a...
I mean, it's kind of a loaded question because you guys tend to be pretty evidence-based, you know, yada yada, but if there's anything that you guys ever, other than him tearing your ACL...
Yeah, other than that, there's maybe some stuff in commodities we slightly disagree on.
Oh, good. So what's your opinion on commodities? A lot of people, you know, we've seen this full cycle where everyone got hot and heavy about commodities in the mid-2000s after they had that monster run, oil trading at $150. And then, of course, every single institution and individual rushed into commodities. And now you have kind of the opposite happening where almost every... institute. I mean, we just saw Harvard is getting rid of all of their commodity exposures and kind of moving to a more passive allocation. Anyway, what's your thoughts on commodities? I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, well, we kind of use it. We're not just like standard buy and hold investors, I would say, in commodities, but more from like a trend follow carry component. You're right. A lot of people are getting out of the crisis alpha strategies, and it's kind of... It's almost like who's going to be the last one standing there still running the crisis alpha strategy. I don't know. I think diversified trend followed managed futures can be beneficial to a portfolio. The question is always, what is the size that you have it in the portfolio, as well as, you know, do you truly understand it? So a lot of times investors don't understand that crisis alpha is great in crisis periods, but you know, in non-crisis periods, it has a low CAGR on average with a high standard deviation. So, you know, you're right. If you if you start investing in some sort of trend-followed commodity or trend-followed futures strategy in 2010, you're probably looking at yourself saying, all right, I'm 7 years into this. What's going on? But yeah, we're still fans of it. Just we do have some slight disagreements within that realm.
And the big thing too with commodities, listeners, is that you have to distinguish too between really what's essentially investable commodities. So you have the spot price of gold, whereas if you really want to invest in most of these commodities, it's through commodity futures. And a lot of the first generation commodity indices were developed not very intelligently, so they had no way to take advantage of the roll yield of the futures contracts, as well as some other things you mentioned like carry and trend. And you've seen a lot of second generation commodity indices that I think are much better, but also from a standpoint of a trend follower, I think that makes even more sense in commodities. We could do an entire show on commodities. Maybe we will at some point. A couple more questions. What is your most memorable, personally, what is your most memorable investment or trade? And this can be either positive or negative. Do you have one that particularly stands out in your mind?
What I would say is, yeah, because I used to, like probably everyone else in that listens to your show, at some point, and probably you still may be, you know, just a stock picker, right? And I would say now I pretty much just am a rules-based investor that invests in portfolios that are generated by rules. But I will say that my last stock, individual stock that I owned, was the Titanic. It was the Premier Exhibitions, which is a stock that basically has rights to the Titanic. So, I went down with that as they realized they couldn't actually dig up the Titanic and make all the money that my theory and research had led me to believe that they would be able to. So,
There was another thematic equity called Odyssey Marine. Do you remember this one at all? This was a company that had the technology to go locate shipwrecks. And so they were going around and unearthing and finding treasure from shipwrecks that had potentially gone down with a bunch of coins. And they were actually really good at it. But the problem became not their business model. The problem became where they would get like detained by Spain.
Yeah.
So Spain would be like, whatever, that was our ship. It went down in the 16th century. And we're keeping all the gold. And so they got stuck in court. I mean, I remember there were some former presidential candidates that were investors. I have actually no idea if the company still exists or what has happened to it. But we'll look it up after the show, post a chart on the show notes and look to it. But you can't imagine a better story for a stock. But my God, I don't think the quantitative value filters would have ever picked it up. A couple other Twitter questions, then we'll wind down. One question, you know, which is a traditional question, is essentially paraphrased, is do most of your quantitative methodologies, you know, you guys are targeting mid and large caps. So for an investor with ability to wade in the smaller waters, does this work in the microcap arena? So looking at below $1 billion market cap, have you guys looked at that at all or any thoughts there?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the research, both ours and other papers, show that, you know, a lot of these anomalies work really well in microcaps, especially if you're going to do like the long short anomalies. And again, then the question is, well, what's like the limit to arbitrage, right? If you try to short a microcap stock, or even just buy a microcap stock, you know, the bid ask spreads and everything become sometimes can overwhelm the strategy. But yeah, definitely value investing works in microcaps. It's just there's clearly a limited scale to that. So one of the reasons we don't focus on that is just due to the scale issue.
And here's another one. I'm going to read the question, and I'm not going to let you answer it because the question is so wonderfully worded. And it says, when enterprise value to EBITDA underperforms, have you ever investigated why? And I'm going to kind of take that question, feel free to answer, but massage it a little bit and say, we didn't really get into factor valuation. So, you know, Rob and Cliff and others have chimed in a lot lately about, you know, certain measures. And so you have a measure like enterprise value to EBITDA that works well over time, but due to flows and the fact that Alpha Architects got $20 billion into their funds, that may have pushed some of these factors to historically expensive levels or historically cheap or whatever it may be. Where do you kind of you guys stand? Where do you stand on the theory there? Is factor timing something you think is possible? Is it something you guys implement at all? Or what's the takeaway?
Yeah, I mean, our view on factor timing, and again, we generally just focus on value momentum, is that it's next to near impossible. So we're kind of more on Cliff Asness' side, I would say, on this one, where we think it's very hard to do. You know, one thing we looked at, I wrote a post about it. It said, hey, a great timing rule would be if, you know, valuation spreads between value and growth get really large, i.e. like the cheap firms are a lot cheaper than the expensive ones, maybe you want to like switch to value. And then if they get narrow, you want to just go to momentum because everything's kind of grinding up. I would say that doesn't really work that well. One thing that could potentially work, and it slightly does, I don't know if it's statistically significant though, is just kind of using like a trend. So, you know, looking at value momentum, saying, hey, value's doing better, let's switch to that. Momentum maybe doing better, let's switch to that. But we don't do that for a couple reasons. One is we like the overall like portfolio diversification benefits of having value momentum. And the second is, you know, sometimes there's tax consequences to doing such a switch. And, you know, we generally view everything, we generally deal with taxable investors. So, you know, making a drastic portfolio move and paying taxes on it is not in the best interest of a taxable investor.
And it's just too much work.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes simpler is better. Jack, we got to let you go. It's been a blast. Where can people find more information if they want to follow you, your writings, your funds? Where do they go?
Yeah, so our website is alphaarchitect.com. My Twitter is jvogues02, and then Wes and our company, where all our blogs come out, is Alpha Architect on Twitter. And yeah, I'd say feel free to stop by our site. We have the free tools such as the Visual Active Share that I pointed out. And it's, again, free for financial professionals to sign up.
So everyone, lesson learned, buy some Voldemort. Also pretend you're a financial professional to get access to all Jack's tools. Jack, it's been a blast. Thanks for taking the time today. I owe you happy hour when anytime you find yourself in Los Angeles.
All right. Sounds good, Ben.
All right, listeners, thanks for taking the time. We welcome feedback and questions. Send them to Jeff at feedback@themebfabershow.com. As a reminder, you can always find the show notes. We'll post a bunch of the links to the articles we talked about today and other episodes at mebfaber.com/podcast. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you're enjoying it, please leave a review. We're almost to 200, so appreciate any and all things you have to say. Thanks for listening, friends, and good investing.
Today's podcast is sponsored by The Idea Farm. Do you want the same investing edge as the pros? The Idea Farm gives small investors the same market research usually reserved for only the world's largest institutions, funds, and money managers. These are reports from some of the most respected research shops in investing. Many of them cost thousands and are only available to institutions or investment professionals, but now they're yours with the Idea Farm subscription. Are you ready for an investing edge? Visit theideafarm.com to learn more.